Hello and welcome to episode 45 of the Wilder podcast. This week we speak to Chris Blake about community land stewardship and how local people can take back control of the land around them through collaboration, long-term vision and trust between communities and public bodies. Chloe, hello.
Hello, Tom.
Another fun-packed few weeks between episodes.
Yes, I'm quite grateful that the pace has slowed down a bit because we had a pretty busy September.
First of all, if you're new to the podcast, welcome. We are founders of the Grange Project, which is a kind of community-focused project looking at loads of things on an 80-acre nature restoration site. Where shall we start? So before we jump into the conversation we've got today, we usually give a slight quick update as to what's happened on the Grange Project over the last couple of weeks. So Chloe, where should we start?
Let's start with the community day, I think.
Okay, so the community day, we have them fairly regularly, every 2 to 3 months, where members of the community, the Grange Project community, get together on the site here and get stuck into a variety of projects or activities on the land. They're normally community-led, so there's people that have got certain expertise or have volunteered themselves to lead activities, ranging from rewilding through to, well, once we had somebody fixing our flail mower because there's a welder, which I thought was brilliant, all the way through to food production. So, I mean, Chloe, do you want to give an update as to what happened on this particular community day?
Yeah, this is the first time we had a September community day, and the time of year meant that it was quite focused on the harvest, which this year has been particularly abundant due to the dry conditions. Like, I read somewhere that it's been the largest apple harvest in 125 years. And I was out in our orchard this afternoon, and I tell you, despite the hours of efforts put in by all of our community members and subsequent volunteers we've had on the project, there are still thousands and thousands of apples hanging on the tree, just taunting me up there. But anyway, we pressed a lot of juice, and hopefully next year when we do this again, people will bring more containers, because we were only stopped in our tracks by a lot of suitable receptacles for juice.
Yeah, and this community day and harvest was particularly special, I think, because of the new market garden that we've had in. You know, your pride and joy, Chloe. Neither of us have ever grown, created, curated a market garden before, but it's been such a valuable addition to the project in so many more ways than just the abundant food that comes off it.
And listeners might remember that in the last episode, Tom slightly, I don't know.
Oh, I've got to sit down for this bit.
was impressed by the size of the polytunnel that we had purchased. And maybe I acknowledged slightly that it was quite a substantial structure. And perhaps that's been borne out in the fact that the polytunnel is still not completed.
Yeah, and that was based on how nervous you were talking about it. Now I've seen it, Chloe. We could house 4 families in there for the year, I guess. It's that big. It's multi-story. I mean, how do you have a multi-story polytunnel?
I definitely hadn't appreciated just how tall it is. It is like a cathedral in there. But what is exciting is I wrote my list of stuff we're going to grow in it. And like, we're going to be growing grapes, melons, aubergines. It's going to be awesome.
Cool. I am looking forward to it. It is, like I said, really enjoying feeding everybody off the market garden we've already got. And every single time that kind of threw you the pride of being able to feed people from what we've grown on site, especially because we're so new to it. It's been great fun. So, okay, we scythe down your wood meadow, Chloe's wood meadow, I'm going to call it going forward. Our Chloe's folly is another thing, because it turns out hand scything a field is a fair amount of work. Luckily, we ran a course on scything and we had some specially trained volunteers that came down and helped us scythe down that field. And it is going to turn into something special and beautiful. I completely acknowledge that. Doesn't stop me cursing you slightly, Chloe, when we're having to hand scythe down this field and collect the grass and drag the grass off somewhere else and then hope that something beautiful is going to grow.
Where else would you put in your skills from your scything course into practice?
This is it. And that's another thing to mention before we go into the interview, because we're pretty much getting towards the end of the top now. But we've had, what, 2 courses now, Ram, since the last episode. We had our scything course, which was fantastic, way better than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be quite dry and, I don't know, not very engaging, but it was the opposite. What an amazing instructor. Nicole was just brimming with knowledge and enthusiasm for scything, and that was so infectious. Everyone came, had a great time, all been fed off the market garden as well. And then we had our climate resilient gardening course. And how did that go, Chloe?
Oh, it was wonderful. Again, Rachel, who has helped us sort of design the market garden and then came to deliver the course, is such a fantastic communicator. And she has that really fantastic balance of being able to hold a structure to kind of keep a rhythm to the day, but also be super flexible in response to everyone's questions, which was really nice. And we've got some cool new habitat up in the garden as a result of the day. I know a lot more about soil. There was just so much to take from the day itself.
And part of this journey is being transparent about kind of how we hope to make revenue as well from what we're doing. We had this aspiration and belief that running courses like the siding and like the climate resilient gardening would be one of the ways in which we would generate revenue from the project. But it's, yeah, we want to make sure all instructors get paid a fair price, and also keeping the price per person at an appropriate level for the activity that we're doing. And it's just, yeah, again, being transparent. What we've learned from these last two courses being ran is that there's no profit in it. It's about, if we put profit in it, we would have to increase the price to a point where we felt uncomfortable with going forward with it. So we're running it at cost. What I mean is cost for the instructor. We're not putting any kind of additional venue hire or rental out of it. We just want to make sure that people come, they get value from what's being ran here, and we'll just have to focus on making money in another way.
And that brings us on to a pretty exciting announcement. Over the last couple of years, Tom and I have been nurturing, developing, experimenting with a new idea, which builds on our strengths, really. My background in facilitation psychology, Tom's background in military entrepreneurship, and the wonderful resource we have on site here, which is the power of wilder nature. And that has brought us to Wilder Away Days.
Kai, do you want to give a quick overview of what Wilder Away Days is and what who we think would benefit from it?
So Wilder Away Days is based on the premise that nobody likes going to a team away day where you're sat in a boring hotel room talking about the same stuff that you've talked about every single away day for the last 5 years with no tangible outcome. Maybe somebody might throw in a bit of paintballing or a quiz, but ultimately we want to do something different, something that really brings teams together in a completely unique context with the power of nature to supplement some fantastic conversations. So it's a combination of some brilliant, hopefully, I'm trying to pick myself up here.
Know yourself.
Facilitation, and that's based really on my background in working with senior leadership teams to support them in developing their communication, strategy, visioning. It's based on the wilder nature that we have around us and using that as a resource to support unique conversations, to create really special team building opportunities where not only are you doing something in nature, which we all know is good for us, but we're also doing something that has purpose and meaning and contributing to habitat restoration. We're also happy to offer some really fantastic seasonally, locally grown food. Like, it doesn't get much closer than grown 200 meters away from the hub. And that is our last asset, really. We have this amazing building, which was architecturally designed, has fantastic views. It feels like you're being hugged in nature. I think someone described it recently. And I do hope that when teams come to join us, that they have a truly memorable experience that also leads to some really tangible outcomes that they can take back into their business environment.
So to summarize, our three secret weapons, the project, the nature that's been around you, the hub itself, purpose-built for teams and corporate teams to come here and be able to do their strategizing in a, you know, a good and comfortable environment, but also easy access to nature. And then finally, you, dear. And it's true. So anyone that knows you and has met you knows that how fantastic you are facilitating those kind of discussions, getting the best out of teams, giving them that cringe and uncringe safe space to kind of operate within. And it's been borne out already. We've had teams on site already. We've had our tester team from people that already know the Grange projects and already asked to come and do team away days. And that's been fantastic. We've also just had our first corporate team book in for their Christmas away day, which I didn't even think about that would be particularly, you know, of interest, but they want to come here, do, you know, the whole strategizing and facilitation in the morning. And then the afternoon, we've got a load of fun activities, including work on the project, but also axe throwing and a gin distillery tour, hopefully, if it's up and running by then, as well as a beautiful and delicious dinner that evening. So it is starting to come together, which gets me a little bit excited.
If you're a listener and you're thinking, oh, well, maybe you're part of a corporate team and you're thinking this could be a cool location to have an away day, or indeed you might have a network which includes people that might be looking for away days, we'd really appreciate any sharing of what we're up to, because ultimately all of the profits from this enterprise goes back into the Wilder Connections charity, which is focused on creating a movement for nature connection in young people. And hopefully all those that know the podcast will know how close that is to both of our hearts. And, you know, this is a way to make it financially sustainable.
It's wilderawaydays.co.uk. The link will be in the show notes. Chloe, would you like to introduce the topic and the guest for today?
Oh, I'd love to. I had the privilege of meeting Chris at actually one of our first team events here.
Oh, that's a segue.
And was just really fascinated to hear about the work he's been doing in communities over most of his career, but particularly this fantastic piece of co-production work he's done in the Rhondda Valley. I think anyone that's interested in community, community land ownership, how you work alongside communities will find something to take away from this episode. And it's really a fantastic story. Hello, Chris, and welcome to the Wilder podcast.
Hello, nice to be here.
In our recent episodes, we've talked a lot about natural capital, the role of farming, wildlife trust, NGOs in delivering landscape recovery, but we haven't really talked about the role that communities can play in this, and particularly the role of community land stewardship. So I'm really excited to get into this conversation today. But before we go into the content, I'm wondering, Chris, whether you could introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners.
Yes, that could take 45 minutes. I'm a Londoner. I was born in London. I've moved to Wales 23 years ago, so I've been here a long time. Previously, I had a career in the publishing industry and with the early days of the internet. But since I've been in Wales, I've really been completely focused on social enterprises and social change. I was one of the founding directors of an organization called the Green Valleys, which has been won a couple of awards, has been running for quite a while. We had a short period when we were, well, 10-year period when we were designing and building micro hydro schemes, very strong on renewable energy generation. And now for that, it was community-owned energy. We really wanted to put the assets into community ownership rather than corporate ownership. So we did that for many years. When the feed-in tariff, it ended, the business model for the small-scale hydro really, really ceased. The Green Valleys is then really focused on land and community land stewardship, which is what we're going to be talking about today. And I've been working in Treherbert and the top of the Rhondda for 7-8 years now, working with communities in the Rhondda to try to encourage and support land ownership, land stewardship, and community control over land. Other things I've been doing, I'm also being involved with Black Mountains College since it was founded. So I was one of the founding trustees of Black Mountains College and is still the chair there. And I'm a volunteer director with a number of organizations, Co-Production Network Wales, and Global Action Plan as well.
Oh, thanks so much, Chris. I mean, we've been trying to get Black Mountains College on the podcast for a while now, so maybe you can give them a nudge because I think it's...
They seem quite busy. Maybe after next batch of students have started.
Yeah, because
I think... You can get iron on.
For listeners that aren't familiar with Black Mountains College, it's a really exciting kind of higher education establishment working to reinvent how education is offered. But look them up, but hopefully we'll get them on the podcast as well. So for the first question then, you mentioned community land stewardship. What do we mean by that term?
Community land stewardship, I guess it does what it says on the tin. I mean, it's the community, the people who live in a place, having direct control over that, how that land is managed. It's as simple as that. And what I would say is that we don't have that. In general, we don't have that. People who live in a place do not have any direct control over how that land is managed. And any control they do have is incredibly indirect. So maybe you can, by making purchasing choices about where you buy your food, you might have a very small influence. But pretty much, and maybe through electing local officials for planning rules, you might have a very small influence, but it's negligible and there's no real effect. I would contend that local people not having control over how land is managed has contributed to some of the ecological, climate and environmental catastrophes that we're facing at the moment, because the people who do have control don't live in the place. They don't have a long-term stake in what happens in that place. And trying to reverse that seems like a very good news. And it really kicked off for me. Well, there were two things. The first thing was I've been to Scotland many times and I happened on holiday to visit Knoydart on the 10th anniversary of their community buyout. And I was really struck by what was happening in the west coast of Scotland, where on the 10th anniversary, they had their own, they owned the land. Because they owned the land, they can control exactly what happens on that land. They had their own forestry business, community-owned forestry business that employed about 6 people. They had their own hydroelectric scheme that powered the community. They ran their own shop. They ran their own holiday accommodation business. The population was, the rural depopulation is a big problem in Scotland. The number of people choosing to live there was really increasing. So through what had been previously a tenant relationship with a feudal landlord, by converting it to community ownership wasn't just changing the community, it was changing the way the lab was managed. It was changing the values which guided how the lab was managed. And I thought that was really inspiring. And years later, this was back in 2010, years later, I'm working in the Rhondda, working with the communities in the valleys. And we were trying to get enough control over the land to put in a microhydro, a small-scale microhydro scheme on natural resources managed land, natural resources Wales managed land, Welsh government owned, NRW managed. And we were having huge problems. So it took us 4 years to negotiate access to put the hydro on there. During that time, the feed-in tariff crashed right down on what would have been an income of £30,000 a year to the community for 20 years. That's £600,000, evaporated to almost nothing. And it just got me thinking, this is bonkers. Why is it so difficult for a community to have the most tiny influence over a land that absolutely surrounds them? And I sat around on this, what then became the Skyline Project, was how could we bring community stewardship, community land ownership to Wales, referencing what I think had been an amazing success in Scotland.
That's really interesting, Chris. And what immediately jumps to my mind is thinking about, I can't remember the statistic, but there's some stat around the role that Indigenous communities play in land management, and how if you go to places where Indigenous populations still have a lot of influence over how land is managed, that's where most of the biodiversity is still preserved globally. And it's when you think about how that makes complete sense, doesn't it? When you live in a place, when you understand the place, when the place speaks to you and you engage with it, unsurprisingly, you're stewarding it in a way that is perhaps more responsible for both nature and people.
And you have a long term stake in it. Some of the work we did in Treherbert, we engaged the community in lots of different ways, and we were dealing with some of the older population there, people in their 80s. And what really struck me is how much a generation in their 80s cared about what that valley would look like in 100 years' time. You know, that was sort of counterintuitive to me, but it's their place. They've lived there all their lives. Of course, it mattered to them passionately what in 3 generations' time was going to be happening there. And that isn't a viewpoint, that isn't a set of values which get expressed through politics or through land management strategies or anything. It's a different voice, which we wanted to be heard.
There's so many directions to go down here, but I'm going to try and bring us back to, because I think when people say community land stewardship, what came to mind for me immediately was people buying and owning the land, and that being the way of bringing the community, you know, because when you own the land, you obviously have ultimate decision making over it. But
yes,
I was thinking about the practicalities of that. And I know that has been possible, like you described in Scotland, but I wonder if you could say a bit more about some of the different models of community land stewardship, and perhaps what works particularly within a Welsh context.
Yeah, so the original thought was, we'll lobby to get community land purchase right to buy enshrined in Welsh law. That'll be easy. I had some very encouraging conversations with civil servants. It looked like it was all going to happen very quickly. And I thought, gosh, this lobbying lark is really easy. But it's different politics, and it's a different land history from Scotland and Wales. And the Welsh government wants to build, not to diminish its forest estate. That's a perfectly valid political choice. So transfer of ownership wasn't really on the cards. So then we started exploring, and I suppose there are different tiers, different ways of controlling the land. That the key thing to me is the ownership, different tenures. You can start with leasehold. So if you don't have freehold, as you said, allows you to do within the law, within the planning structure, of anything you want with that land. Leasehold would be permission to manage that land according to some principles which agree with the landowner for 25, 100 years, which comes pretty close to the freedoms. You get full economic rights. You get the right to enjoy it yourself. You can manage it. There is a framework which you mustn't breach the overall terms of the lease, but that leasehold is pretty powerful. You can also have management agreements. So you could agree with the owner that we will manage this land for a period of 25 or 50 years according to some principles. It's not a legal leasehold. And if we don't manage it according to the guidelines, then you can take that away. But again, it gives an element of control. And then the last method, and the method that we ended up exploring and using in the Rhondda, was actually to co-produce with the managing agent and the community what that future plan is going to be. And that co-production process proved very successful and quite interesting. So the principle of co-production is that, so in the other models, in the freehold model and the leasehold model and management agreement, really with some guidance, the community is free to run that and make the decisions on that area. The co-production, you come together and you're pooling expertise, actually. You're taking the forestry, NRW, who's got forestry management expertise, and you're taking the community who don't know, let's say, pretty much anything about forestry, but have a very strong sense of what their values, what's important to them, what the future wants to be. And you put them together over an extended period of time. Our co-production process took a year. We had professional facilitators. We had everybody in the room. And we came up with what we called a future forest vision, a shared document, which was both sensible and realistic from a forestry point of view, but was built on the values and the aspirations of the community. And it was a negotiation. You know, it started with, you know, the community wanting something which was impractical. For example, don't touch the larch trees, which were dying of disease. Don't touch them. We want them to be there and to rot naturally. And then NRW will come back and say, manage and say, yeah, you could do that, but the fire risk and the physical risk of falling trees is so great, we would have to close the forestry from public access. And then the community goes, okay, so let's not do that. That's not a good idea. That doesn't fit what we want. And then you co-produce a solution. And I think in some ways, in the co-production exercise we did in the Ronda, we ended up with a better plan than either the forestry people on their own could have done or the community on their own could have done. You've got a pooling. It isn't such an obvious and direct form of control. And the community doesn't have to be involved in implementing that. But what you have got is that the values and the aspirations of the community are enshrined in that management plan. And our future forest vision was for 100 years. It wasn't a 3-year, 5-year plan. It was a long-term vision for how that land will be managed. And so it's just a way of getting the values of the local community expressed without the responsibility that comes with freehold or leasehold, but in trying to get. So it's another model of achieving the same thing, which is local values determining how the land is managed.
Paint a picture for me in terms of what kind of, with that example you're giving, what's the size of the area you're talking about? And is it all just a forest or was there more to it?
It's mainly forestry. So that, and this happened right across the valleys after the coal industry went and the coal spoil, the area was heavily planted with commercial conifer forestry, right across all of the valleys. Often on slopes, which are completely uneconomic to harvest, which is one of the ironies, and on old coal spoil, which is unstable. So maybe not the smartest decision. It completely transformed the valley. The top of the Ronda, we're talking, well, the whole top of the area is sort of 600 hectares, which is 6 square kilometers. I mean, that's a lot of land. We focused our co-production process on the northwest side, and it's about 220 hectares to 2 square kilometers. We're not talking about a couple of acres of community woodland. We're talking about a landscape scale, things which make a difference to a landscape.
How did you get everyone around the table? Because you're going to have to get true crow production, you need all those stakeholders invested at the start of the process. And how do that even occur?
You're right. That is tricky. I mean, I was working with an organization called Welcome to Our Woods, which is a community organization in Intraherbert that's been running for about 10 years now. And they have a very good relationship with the community. They're a trusted local organization. It's not Chris Blake coming in and saying, let's talk about it. I work with them and they have a wide membership and a lot of people who care very passionately about the future of that forest. So engaging the community was not difficult at all. We recruited what we called a design group of about 35 local individuals who would commit to be part of the co-production process. We didn't pay them. We did give them quality snacks and drinks, but there was no payment. The tricky thing is then you have to get the public authority, in this case, NRW, who are the forest managers, to commit to do that. And I can understand why they're very reluctant to do that. Their view is, well, you know, why are we going to compromise? Why are we going to constrain our management plan to meet our management objectives by what the community thinks? And we've got to really pull out the difference here between co-production and consultation. In consultation, even quite elaborate forms of consultation, the plan is developed by the agency and then presented to the community for comment, and it may or may not get changed as a consequence of that comment. Very often doesn't get changed. Co-production is you start with a blank sheet of paper, and you literally co-produce that plan. Now, that is a ceding of power from the agency to community. It's a pooling of sovereignty over those decisions. And that is not something that most local authorities, public bodies are very comfortable with. And it took quite a bit of encouragement, quite a bit of political pressure and other things to get them to join in the process. But at the end of that process, it was a revelation. I mean, we've got some of the people involved in the process were saying at the beginning, well, you know, this is just going to be a forum where the community will shout at us. They don't like us. It'll just be a place for a lightning rod for those discontents. But all right, we'll give it a go. It's kind of reluctantly. At the end of the process, it was quite an honest approach. Wow, you know, no, it works. The community listen and are doubly committed to listen. They worked out solutions together. And I think it will lead to a long-term change in the way that forest works and is managed. And it will be better for nature. It'll be better for the environment, better for carbon. It'll be better and more economically viable for the local community as well. I think it'll be a win-win. But it's a way of, I'm not advocating it instead of or better than freehold ownership or a long-term leasehold, but in situations where, for whatever reason, transfer of asset is not politically or practically possible, there are ways in which you can get community influence and community, yeah, control over that forest without the legal structures of ownership or leasehold.
I wonder if you could give me a couple of examples where maybe the dial as part of this co-construction process tips slightly towards community. So what were the additional benefits that they managed to influence out of the process and vice versa, or probably the same question, but what were some of the compromises that Natural Resources Wales came to in order that they probably wouldn't normally do?
One of them I've already touched on, which is that, you know, the community's first instinct was that we don't want these trees all cut down. We don't want the clear felling a conifer that's been there for 40 years is a mess. I mean, it completely changes for 30 years, 20, 30 years, the aspect of the valley. It creates the enormous lorries trundling through the small, narrow valleys roads. Create a mess. You've got an increased risk of flooding because the mud is exposed to heavy rains and you get a lot of problems. So do we have to cut down the trees? These trees don't, can we have to come down? And there was a compromise there that was reached. One of the big compromises were that these trees, once it's accepted that those trees would need to be felled, they can be felled in small coupes, 5-hectare batches. So we'll do this one this year and another one that doesn't adjoin at the same time. And then we'll come back and then we'll replant those trees either with broadleaf, so we'll stop timber production there, but some places you can still do timber production, but let's redo the replanting with mixed species of conifer, which can then be designed, so the forest can be designed for what is called continuous cover forestry, where you take out the bigger trees as they mature and leave the rest. So the difference between clear fill and continuous cover, if you take a 100-year perspective on the forest, you get more timber out of continuous cover than you do out of a 40-year clear fell cycle. But it's much more labor intensive. And it's a different kind of labor. It's a labor that suits a local forestry operation. So clear fell, you need to come in with equipment that costs £1 million. An out-of-area contractor comes in, causes a mess, takes all the timber, and there are no jobs and no economic benefit for the local community. Continuous cover forestry means that after 10 or 15 years, when you have to start thinning, there is local continuous work every winter season, which would suit a local operation. And so we've enshrined that, the felling regime, the planting regime, in anticipation of a different model of extraction, one that won't be there for 20, 30 years. So it's very long-term thinking, but it's a different way of thinking, which we wouldn't, maybe NRW would have come up with that themselves. I don't think so. And it's not saying we don't want any more conifer production in this valley, but we have the conifer production we will have in the future will be better for the visual environment, will be better for soil erosion and flood prevention, and will be have a much better impact on economy and jobs.
No, I really do love that. And I thank you for that answer, because that really has kind of solidified that journey and the thought process in my mind a lot more. And obviously that I can see the clear value on all levels, but I'm thinking if there's a community who has a stakeholder like Natural Resources Wales in their local area, what were the things that you'd say to that community to get Natural Resources Wales to the table? What's the value add to them, or the thing that they'd prick their ears up and go, oh, yeah, no, okay, now I'm interested. Let's sit down and have a chat.
Yeah, there's a fundamental question here, which I did some research that through Bangor University last year before, which sort of gets to the heart of this, which is I looked at both in Forestry Land Scotland in Scotland and Natural Resources Wales. And I looked at what their stated goals are, what their aims are, what their values are, what they're trying to achieve with their land management. And those come from governments. They come from the Scottish government, they come from the Welsh government, some that comes from Westminster. And they have, you know, there's nothing wrong. They're aiming at biodiversity improvements. They're aiming, they want to grow commercial timber, and we need commercial timber. You've got to remember the UK is the second largest importer of timber in the world after China. So it's not like we can just stop timber production because we'll just be outsourcing it to somewhere else. So timber is important production. But biodiversity, community usage, they've got all these great goals for their forestry. But these are also organizations which have been cut, and number of staff has been reduced quite dramatically in some cases. And they're not able to, they don't have the resources or the management attention or the culture of risk-taking to transform some of these forests. This was what came out from the research. Where you get a community involved, and I looked at four case studies, two in Scotland, two in Wales, where you get a community involved, the community bring a number of assets which public body can't do, which actually get things done which are in line with government policy. So by Welcome to Our Woods being involved in Johor, they're able to bring an entrepreneurial energy, a local passion for a local place. They're able to bring independent grant funding, which government bodies can't get, so from the Lottery or from other trusts and foundations. They're able to mobilize volunteers. They're able to just get things done. And so co-production, sharing tenure, enables those woods to be managed in a way that to achieve outcomes, public goods, of better carbon capture, better, and which are not incompatible with what the public sector wants, but it's just delivering it. So actually, it's win-win. The community get local jobs, volunteering, sense of control, sense of ownership, improved sense of place. The public body gets some of the unlocks resources and delivers changes in forest and land outcome, which they can't deliver. It's not that they don't want to deliver it. They just haven't got the resources or the power to do it. And so I would say it's a win-win. It doesn't happen very much because there is still a culture within a lot of public bodies of holding control and not having the confidence to release control. And it is interesting in Scotland because the legislation supports and encourages land ownership. And I think there are something like only 3% of Scotland is in community ownership. I think it's something like 2/3 of the Outer Hebrides are community owned. There are 300 individual projects. In Scotland, the Forestry Land Scotland, the Scottish government, has said, get on with it. You know, we trust you. We're going to give you complete, we're going to give you freehold tenure. We're going to give you the cash to buy the freehold and manage it how you want to. And that's an element of trust, which has been more difficult to achieve in Wales, I would say. And one of the things the co-production process did was a process which built trust, which built mutual trust. It broke down a barrier. It got NRW to realize that the community was thoughtful, not cavalier, had the best interests of the forest at heart, and gave the community time to learn that NRW were not just rapacious profit maximizers.
And I know I promised I would stop asking questions, but my last reflection is that this co-production process, what I particularly like is one of my biggest criticisms of landowners when they say they're going to do the right thing or manage things in line with nature, whatever it might be. The hardest thing is that how do you hold landowners accountable to ensure that they're doing the thing that they should be doing? What I love about this co-production is you've got a community that's invested in the process who, you know, will hold Natural Resources Wales accountable for sticking to what they agreed.
Yes, that's right. There isn't a legal agreement. At the end of the scope production process, there isn't a legal agreement. There's an understanding. There's a document that says these are the principles which other future forest resource plans. And at the moment, the forest resource plan, which is the plan which NRW creates about how they're going to manage the forest, it's an NRW project. They do it and they implement it. So that's that. Yeah, that change of control is still there. But the forest resource plan has to be grounded, has to be built on that foundation of that future forest vision. So that's the control. There is a form of control here, is that what's very important to NRW is that their timber gets FSC certification. And FSC certification, if you have worked with a community to come up with your plans, that you can't change them. You can't ignore them. You breach your FSC certification rules if you've done a fantastic, you know, consultation or engagement exercise, and then you think, we'll do something else. So there is a form of control, but it's a relationship based on trust. You know, there's nothing legally that a community could do if NRW said, new manager comes in, tears it up and says, right, my rules now. That can happen. but the political, the sense of it doesn't happen because you've built up some trust in the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's one of the things that we've been doing over the 20th and 21st centuries is that we've been outsourcing decision and management decisions to organizations. And they've become distant and they've become far, and they're not under any form of direct local democratic or political control. Big public institutions are some of them. Sometimes those are private corporations that we've done. And control has been leeching away from place into bureaucracies, private and public bureaucracies. And that, I think, has contributed to much of the damage that we see.
I'm going to resist the temptation to step down into the whole thing around citizens' engagement and participatory bureaucracy and citizen assemblies, because I feel like that's a whole other podcast we could...
It is a podcast, but it does link here, and you can argue. So the co-production process modelled on a model called the Citizens Panel. So it was we were using deliberative democracy models in our consultation process. Because it's a form of giving voice. And one of my criticisms of citizens' assemblies, they're great for creating citizen-led, wish lists. We want this, we want that. But if you haven't got the public agencies who can deliver those changes in the room, all you've got is a wish list, which you can hand to them and they go, oh, thanks very much. So co-production, you can do the same models, but you need the executive agency that can make the change has to be part of the process. And that's one of the things we learned. So the Skyline process has been going on for the very first time we did our community consultation without NRW or the local authority in the room. And it was great, and everyone was really passionate and very excited. And this is what we want. It'd be great. And we had a whole long list of things and we gave it to the bodies and thanks very much. Yeah, we'll consider these. And you don't have power. So there's a very big difference. And when that didn't work, we then engaged on the co-production process where we said, go, do this together. You've got the power. We've got the passion and the vision and a sense of place. And that we have to work. We work on this together. And that is what has allowed change to come about.
And just in that practical sense, I think it was really helpful for you to outline the kind of contrasting approaches of a consultation, which is often a written document that gets put online that people are encouraged to read and respond to when they have the capacity. And often it engages a particular sort of person that is interested in reading consultations. And obviously, yeah, co-production has a very different flavour. And particularly when you're talking about how you have these critical stakeholders in the room and attending to the power that's associated with some of those different positions. I'm wondering what these meetings actually look like. Are they, are they facilitated? Do you have equal balance between representatives? Are you using kind of creative methods to engage people? I wonder if you could speak to that a bit.
No, absolutely. So we used a lot of creative methods in engaging people throughout the process. I mean, we recruited artists to work with communities. We made things together. We did some really great, I think some very good work. I mean, it's done quite a lot. One of the really interesting ones that we did, I always liked, was we did a timeline. I got one of those big rolls of wallpaper and we spread it out on the church and in the community hall right across the floor. And we did a timeline. We went back to the last ice age. So we went back 10,000-15,000 years. And it was a really interesting process because all of a sudden industrialization, coal mining doesn't define the past and define the present. There's a small interlude in a period in which humans' relationship with that landscape has been very different. And it suddenly gave a wider perspective. It was quite an interesting process and it changed it. Oh, right. So that only lasted 150 years and we've got 10,000 years and humans have been working this and managing that landscape. And actually, the call to reinstate what we've lost in an industrial sense then diminishes. And it's easier to reimagine a future which is different from your immediate past. And it's just one example of the kind of artistic thing. The terms of the process for the co-production process. So we used a professional co-production network, Wales, and they were fantastic. I thought they were so good that I've now joined them as a volunteer director. That's good. But that is really useful because they are able to convene that space and to hold the space, and they're neutral. They can be trusted by both parties as being, technical facilitators without a predetermined view. So I think that's very important to the process. We treated it as a citizens panel, so we brought evidence to the panel. So the panel consisted always, we had to have NRW people in the room. We had to have the design community design group in the room. We worked out what are the themes that are important to people. And then we brought in expert evidence to that group. But it's the element of giving evidence to a group who then decides how to interpret and question that evidence and then make a decision. So I think what happens a lot is that we defer to experts. Oh, he's a forestry management expert. He's got a degree in forestry management and he's, you know, chartered forester. He must know. We'll let him make the decisions. And even in consultations in all sorts of processes, people defer, oh, you're the expert. But actually, forestry, you know, a chartered forester, we have all the technical knowledge, but they will lack the sense of place and the passion and of engagement for the future. And so you have to break this dependence and this deferral to experts. And so we treat them very deliberately as evidence givers. And so we got evidence. We had a professional forester who came in. We had a permaculture expert came in. We had a forest education person came in. We had a boriculture person coming in. So we had all these experts, energy person, people coming in, talking about other case studies, talking about examples, being questioned by the panel, by the technical NRW panel, by the Zones Assembly, and then left. Those experts don't shape what's in the plan. And then the panel, which, you know, the combined things, having heard that evidence, then come up with a set of values, very important. We distill out the set of shared values and a number of principles for the development of the forest out of what we've heard. And so it needs to be created by the group and not commissioned from experts. And I think that's a really important voice about the power transfer. And a lot of this is about power transfer. It's about pooling power, the authority which has all the power and is pooling it, not giving it completely, but pooling it with the community, and then taking the power using experts, but not pushing the power onto the experts.
What I'm hearing this process is how rich it is, how the creativity, the investment that's need to be made on all parties. And I was thinking about the funding investment as well to do justice to this. You know, if you were somebody that was, I don't know, you lived in an area where there was potentially an opportunity to start this process, was it grant funding that enabled it to happen?
Yes, it did. And you're right to focus on this. We did. We got a grant from the Welsh Government's Foundational Economy Programme, which was a few years ago. We got about £30,000. We could have done it for less. We did. It took about £30,000. Big chunk of that is we spent quite a lot of time recording audio and film recording the process, so we could make a films and share it with others. Now, you wouldn't always have to do that, but that we did. But it does cost money. It'll cost £10,000 or £20,000 for the facilitation and the kind of thing, convening and the process. There's also a cost from the NRW by committing to be part of that process are taking up management time. And I completely acknowledge that. They've got to commit people to come to the evening sessions. They're typically evening sessions. They've got to participate. They've got to liaise with internal people. So it's not a cost-free exercise. What I would say is that it, in relation to the long-term benefits and public goods that are delivered, those setup costs are not enormous, but it does need either public or grant funding to trigger it. And it will get more routine and cheaper as we do more of it in the future.
So I can really see a process like this working when you've got a stakeholder like NRW, which, you know, has a degree of needing to address the kind of perspectives of the public and community around it. But I wonder whether there are any examples of sort of similar projects or using a co-production process that have worked with more private landowners.
Generally don't know whether private projects have gone through a co-production process. I mean, private landowners, it's often been a sale. It's been a sale of the asset. And that sometimes their communities, you can unleash so much power and so much good if a community can take control of a land asset in some way. And they can do that through asset transfer, through buying it, raising the funds, and doing local share issues, applying for grants, getting some government grants to do it. And whether it's a local authority or a private owner, just go for it. Ask the question. And there are a lot of well-meaning private landowners out there who would be absolutely delighted to work with communities to achieve that. You can raise the cash and do the freehold acquisition, and there are rules and support and legislation and guidance which encourages that use. If people won't sell, then a leasehold. a long leasehold, which may not require the same capital asset, but if it's for long enough, can achieve pretty much the same goals that you want to, or enter into a co-production agreement where you work out together how this asset will be managed to meet the values of that local community. All of those are open, and I would really encourage communities to start that conversation. Look around at what's happening. Talk to other communities that have been successful in doing this. In Wales, there's just been a government commission, which I and a number of other people sat on, looking at the future of asset transfer in Wales, both from public and private. And this is the report's going to be out in the autumn, and guidance to Welsh Government perhaps to change legislation around this and to make it easier to do that. So I think governments in all of the home nations are listening to this. It's an agenda which I think they realise that the government agencies, I'm talking about the government, the public land, haven't got the capacity to maximise the public goods from that land, and that some form of partnership or transfer of asset is a sensible way to go. So I think the mood is changing in our favour, and start that conversation. There are local authorities have guidance on asset transfer. You have to be wary, and there has been some history of local authorities dumping the assets which are difficult to manage, which have high running costs, and they can't otherwise sell on communities. But you can go beyond that. And there are lots of bodies like Locality in England or Development Trust Association in Wales, or the equivalent in Scotland, who will help communities, advise them on establishing, doing fundraising, doing share issues, fundraising, how to negotiate with public or private bodies for asset transfer. So there is a lot of support out there.
Yeah, and that was one of my final questions. We are sadly come to the end of the conversation, but I don't want this to be a hospital pass over to you, Chris. So I hope, is there already a website that exists that collates these different methods that you've just described into one website with a kind of a flow chart and advice and guidance of where to go next? Because that sounds really sensible direction to go.
Probably, I can't think of it offhand. What I would say is that, and I think it differs with each of the four home nations because the legislation differs, Northern Ireland, Scotland, England and Wales. I think probably the first place, the places to go in England would be Locality or the Plunkett Foundation. There are other organisations as well. In Scotland, you've got Community Land Scotland, which you can guess what that's about, and they will have the best place. In Wales, we don't have a Community Land Wales, unfortunately, but maybe Development Trust Association of Wales is one of the first places to go, which is the equivalent of Locality in Wales. And the Development Trust Association of Northern Ireland would be a good place to go. These are organisations, these are not-for-profit organisations, which have a commitment to community ownership, community asset ownership, development, economic development. And a good point. Whether there is in each of those places a website where you guides you through the process, I'm not so sure. Certainly, I can't think of one in Wales.
Well, thank you very much for your time. Your dog's had a nicely timed cameo right at the end of that, which is perfect timing for saying they probably want to go for a walk. What we normally do is just throw the ball back to the guest at the end and just say, is there anything you feel like we haven't covered or you feel like it's important to bring up?
This is the in our time question at the end, isn't it? No, I suppose I would re-emphasize that actually this really matters, that a lot of the land. And I'm focusing on land as an asset here. The management of land has led to biodiversity, climate, contributed to climate and other crises, and social, rural depopulation, all sorts of things have led to these problems. And that addressing that at scale is a really important issue. Now, one small community project doesn't sound that very big, but if we can get enough of those, you will actually change. We need to change the value. So every landscape is an expression of values. How the hill, the Black Mountains hill that I look out to up here, it looks the way it does because some values about what's important are being expressed. And the question I've got is, whose are those values? And I think it's been for food production, it's been food retailers, food manufacturers, retailers, shareholders. And those shareholders could well be for Monsanto. They could be in a different continent. And the maximization of their profits and the getting a regular form of profit dictates are the dominant values that control how this landscape is managed. And community ownership, community control over land is a way of reversing that. And it's really important because what we've done over the last 50, 60 years has been catastrophic and we've got to reverse it.
Well, I think that's a pretty powerful note to end on there, Chris. So thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. And we look forward to kind of seeing developments in the Rhondda of these fantastic approaches.
Thanks very much.
I think the first thing that stood out for me from this conversation is I'd always intuitively thought about the benefits of co-production for the community. Like that kind of seemed obvious. Let's take some power back and let's make sure community voices are heard. But what really struck me from Chris's conversation was around what the communities can bring to the table in terms of the ability to access grant funding, the volunteer time, and actually how it's a win-win for both sides.
Yeah. It also made me realize that I am so fundamentally not suited to any of this co-production concepts. Just my personality. I am very impressed by what can be achieved with patience and logic and a researched approach. And hats off to anyone that can do that because it takes so much skill. And I think having in your heart that innate belief that everyone is in it for the same reasons and wants to get a really positive result out of it. Optimism, maybe that's the word I'm looking for to get there. But clearly, if you are resilient, if you keep pushing things forward, if you are patient, if you are resilient, all the things I've just said, then positive things that can come out of it.
I think it's also a helpful reminder about this innate human goodness, perhaps. I think we've been slightly conditioned to imagine that humans are sort of fundamentally selfish beings that only really care about their own patch of anything. And actually, it was Chris's point around how he was sort of surprised there were people in their 80s who were really caring about future generations. And I was thinking, yeah, I can see that. I can see that actually on an individual level, when you sit down with any person, fundamentally, they want the right thing for their community and their space and for the planet and for future generations. I think we just sometimes get caught up in a bit of a system that positions us to end up prioritizing other things.
Yeah, and maybe that's to do with ignorance. It's to do with that lack of knowledge. And what I particularly liked about this co-production concept was that bringing in the quote-unquote experts or witnesses, or what the phrase that he used, and allow them to provide information to everybody to hear the same information together in the room, so that then it can be discussed from a position of knowledge, not from a position of ignorance. And I think that is a really positive thing. I think can be taken forward not just for co-production of land, you know, acquisition or stewardship, but actually wider and more into the political landscapes.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. I was really thinking where else we can use this process. And, you know, there are things like participatory budgeting, where essentially you get people together with a budget for their town or local area. And you ask them, really, what would you do with this money? And how would you spend it on the basis of, you know, shared knowledge by experts. And I was thinking as well about the NHS. Like, there's some really tough questions the NHS has to answer about where it's going to invest its limited resource, because it just cannot keep on meeting escalating need within the budget it has. And actually, why can't we use a process like this so that local people have a say over local services?
Again, it takes someone like Chris to facilitate that. It's not an easy thing to do, and to do it properly and to do it well and do it, you know, facilitating discussions independently. I also, you know, I wish I had enough time to talk to him about how people at the Co-Production Network of Wales, how do they maintain that neutral? Because you can't be unbiased. It's just human nature. But how do you pull in checks and balances to ensure that you're as unbiased as you possibly can be and present it in a neutral way? Quite interesting a topic, really.
And it connects a little bit into my world around facilitation as well. So I'd love to get more involved in those sorts of projects, but anyway, one step at a time.
To be fair, that's why I'm so fundamentally not suited, because I just sit there and tell people how to do it. And anyone that knows me will know that is so true. Doesn't mean I'm right, by the way.
No, but you do get stuff done. So, you know, there are, you know, I think there are merits to both approaches, but yeah, I'm definitely more in the bringing people along through collaboration rather than instruction. But anyway, I think just as a last point, because I'm aware, again, this is going to be a very long episode, but the good news is that the Future Generations Commissioner of Wales has recently made a pledge that we should be looking at a community right to buy in Wales. And it'll be, I think it's on our various different manifestos in the run-up to the Welsh election next spring.
Awesome. We've pretty much come to the end of the podcast. Now, there is a sensitive topic we now have to cover. Is it better that I do this, Chloe, or you?
I think because of your relationship, it's better if you do it.
Okay. it's a bit of a long story. So if you're at the end of the podcast, you want to stop, feel free. But this is about the pigs on the project. So for those that are new to the Grange project, we had two, there you go, I've given it away, British Saddleback pigs here that were doing amazing jobs. They had a job for life. It was only down to them that could mess it up, because they were ecosystem engineers. They were doing so much good for the biodiversity. They were super friendly animals, and I'd basically fallen in love with them. I think I said on one previous podcast that I love them slightly more than the children. Maybe I just said that offline. I don't know. But that being said, we had a number of episodes with them where they were being kind of beyond friendly and into aggressive territory with guests on the project and ourselves. It wouldn't matter if it happened once or twice, but it was starting to become a semi-regular occurrence, and it's starting to get a little bit dangerous. And unfortunately for the pigs, they've had to go to the abattoir. Now, we were always intending to bring the pigs on site for meat and allowing them to do the nature restoration and then taking them away for meat. But because I fell in love with them, I wanted to keep them for as long as we possibly could, forever, until they died of old age, if that was practical. But unfortunately, that hasn't been practical, and they've had to go for meat, which is unfortunate for a lot of people in the community who equally love the pigs as much as I did. But on the flip side of the coin, for the people who are still reducing their meat intake, but still eating meat, they are going to be quite delicious when they come back.
I suppose from an ecological perspective, you don't really get a lower carbon footprint pig than what we have here, because they had no supplementary feed. They have done a fantastic job to promote biodiversity. And if you're going to eat meat, and I completely respect a lot of people's reasons not to do that, then we hopefully these guys have had a pretty good life.
Yeah. We'll probably get flack, but ultimately, every decision has been made based on logic and reasoning, and we can't have aggressive livestock on the land. We've got guests, we've got schools, we've got children, we've got volunteers, we've got the community on site regularly, we've got footpaths through the land, etc. So it just, unfortunately, we didn't have any other options, and no other landowners will want quote unquote aggressive pigs on their land either for all the same reasons. So this was the option that was left to us. And to be fair, meat production was always part of the conversation around this. So, right, well, that was a semi-downer to finish on the episode on, but it has been a fascinating episode, and I hope people have taken away some inspiration for something maybe that they can do with their communities moving forward. Chloe, is that it?
I think so, Tom.
Until next episode, let's go.